good evening. This is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls for the time being. We have with us, hopefully, very, very soon, Andre Michael Eagleton. We're going to be talking about his book, Thieves in the Temple, America Under the Federal Reserve System. And Andre has his own radio program in Florida, and he's written a fascinating book going into the background of one of the greatest scams ever perpetrated on civilized people. And that is that if you give some good people control over the monetary system and let them print all the money that they want, they will do just as what is best for us common people. And all you need to do is go back and read what Aristotle wrote, where he said, you know, there's nothing wrong with fiat money as long as you have men who are totally idealistic as rulers and in control of this thing. But, of course, he recognized that you really could not get people exactly like that. And so they had gone into a fiat money system in ancient Greece. He saw what happened. And Greece, of course, once a great free society, had adopted the concepts of democracy, and the people began voting into power, the men who promised them to give them the most. And the only way to give the people all the things they wanted was, of course, to increase the money supply. And for a time that worked, and then you had to increase the money supply again and again and again until you had a monetary collapse and with it the moral fabric of the society. Well, there's nothing new under the sun. It's happened dozens of times since then. It happened in ancient Rome. Rome, actually, divided into two parts, the western part, the eastern part. The western part went into a fiat money system, and the system collapsed, and of course, Rome fell. The eastern part, centered in Constantinople, maintained a stable currency. And, of course, it persisted up until at least about the 1300s or 1400s. So you have to have a stable currency, and frankly, we do not have a stable currency in America. Right now, we've got Andre on the line. Andre, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Thank you so very much for being with us. And, of course, you've done a lot of work studying the background of the Federal Reserve System. Yeah, I sort of suspect there's probably not 1 in 1,000 people in America who really understands the scam.
You're probably right, and this is why the scam has been perpetuated for so long here in America, is the fact that people really don't know about it, and it works to the banker's advantage because anonymity is their most cherished asset.
All right, fine. Well, how did you get interested in this whole incredible story?
I tell you, it's once I found out that the Federal Reserve was a privately owned corporation, and the fact that our Constitution has not sanctioned the privatization of our monetary policy, I naturally wanted to know more, and the more I found out, the more I had to learn, and the more I had to learn, I felt that everybody should know what is the core problem within our society today. I mean, you know, we can work for our own advancement in society, you know, in whatever level we can do as individuals and as individual groups in our society, and then we're still going to have to deal with malign monetary policy.
You're absolutely right, and we're going to be back in just a moment with Andre. And first, hold your calls for the time being, because we want to develop these ideas before we actually do begin to take calls. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Andre Eagleton, and we're talking about talking about thieves in the temple. How do you pronounce your last name, Andre?
It's pronounced Eglishon.
Eglishon, okay. And so anyway, of course, the Central Reserve System, or the Federal Reserve System, is a privately owned central bank. Now, who really owns a central bank? Who really determines the policies that determine the monetary policy of our country, and who profits?
Well, the Federal Reserve is a privately owned bank, as you said, and it is owned by the banks themselves. And it is a corporation that is set up for profit. They are the ones that reap the profits. The Federal Reserve is not taxed. They're not audited. It's an unaccountable, unelected system by which monetary policy in the United States is completely and totally controlled. And the American people are not the beneficiaries of what the Congress had originally envisioned for American society, in that Congress was supposed to direct our monetary policy and not a privately owned central bank. So, you know, it's not a part of government, and we are the losers in this whole sordid tale here.
But, you know, of course, most people are going to look and say, but look how good we've had. I mean, look at the tremendous prosperity in our country today. And how could anything that is so good, that has provided so much wealth for so many people, be bad? How do you respond to that?
Well, I will say that our prosperity is not a solid prosperity that's built upon any type of fiscal solvency. It's a false sense of prosperity, because we're living largely on a borrowed prosperity in America today. There's only three ways a government can raise revenue. We can either tax it, borrow it, or print it. Now, in 1913, we went out of the printing business. We gave a privately owned central bank, the Federal Reserve, the unconstitutional authority to issue our currency, so we can't print money. And that only leaves taxation and borrowing, and that's what we've been subject to. Unfortunately, politicians lack the will to spend within their means, and they lack the will to tax, so they borrow. And it's the worst tax of all, because it's an invisible tax. The more money they borrow, the more money it adds to circulation, and the more money we have in circulation, the less our money will buy every single year. And this is why the dollar has lost approximately 1,000% of its purchasing power since 1913, when they created the Federal Reserve.
And I think that's what people really don't understand. Gee, I've got more money now. My house is worth so much more. The average house in my community goes for over $800,000. I'm really rich. No, I'm not. And we'll be back in just a moment here. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Andre was basically talking about what happens, how the government, how I should say the Federal Reserve System, creates money out of nothing. And although it appears that we have more and more money, the truth of the matter is, why, of course, the value of the money we have is progressively losing its value. And the people then who've worked hard all of their lives and think they have security in their annuities, in their bank accounts, in their CDs, and the money they have deposited in the bank, the pension fund, are in for a very rude awakening, because the whole financial structure of this country today is on the edge of a financial precipice. Within the last week, both the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund have expressed their deep concern that America is going to drag the whole world down in a vortex of destruction, and the whole world monetary system really hangs by a thread at the present time, and people throughout the world are really concerned about this. Andre, what do you foresee happening in the future?
Well, excuse me, Stan, I can tell you this, that the Fed is going to continue to try to guide the economy until something cracks right now. There have been 11 times that we've had rate hikes in the last 50 years, and only one soft landing. So can we reasonably expect that in this process now of restriction that the Federal Reserve is implementing on the country, that we will have a soft landing now? No, I don't think so. I think first we're going to see the financial markets affected, and then the overall economy. So the Fed is going to continue to raise interest rates, and people are going to get hurt, no question about it. And it comes, unfortunately, at a time when we're seeing a rapid rise in gas prices all across the country. If you look in the northeastern United States, the average price of a gallon of regular is $2.35. In the south, it's about $2.28. And in the western states, most of them are paying over $3 per gallon for regular gasoline. Now, this is coming at the same time the Fed is being forced to raise interest rates to deal with inflation. And I can tell you that this promises to have a very depressive effect on our economy. We will continue to see the dollar erode as a result of the economic instability here in our country. And consequently, the guardian of the world's greatest reserve currency is going to continue to become deeper and deeper its greatest debtor until most of Asia and the rest of the world no longer wants dollars, and they're going to begin to opt for no other reason, diversification, they're going to begin to opt for the euro as a reserve currency. So, and according to Tony Blair, I believe he said it was by the year 2012, the dollar will no longer be the world's currency reserves. This means we're going to have to trade in dollars for euros before we can go buy oil. So if we think that oil is, the price of a gallon of gas is extremely high now, it's going to be even higher, you know, once the dollar finally loses its hegemony.
And I really think that it's only a matter of time before the people of this once great country are impoverished because we've allowed the wicked people to gain control of our monetary system. And you even talk in your book about really what happened in ancient Rome. Do you want to touch a little bit about the history of other countries and other societies that have tried to create a fiat money system such as we have?
Absolutely. Fiat money is, first of all, by definition, it's anything can be used as money. As a matter of fact, during England, under I think it was King Henry, they used a stick of wood, the tally stick system, and it was used to expand the kingdom of Europe. Back during Rome, this goes into being able to assess how that the power to issue countries' monies have always gone back and forth between political scientists and monetary scientists. Caesar took the power to issue money back from the goldsmiths and began to issue money from the Roman treasury, and he built the great monuments of Rome. Well, after his assassination, the money changers took over, and debt-free money ceased, and Rome was thrust into serious economic depressions. So, and this self-same back-and-forth movement of the control of money was pretty much the status quo in the development of our civilization until 1913, when the Federal Reserve and its proponents, the monetary scientists, decided to basically ally themselves with the political scientists, and they formed a union. And this is why the Federal Reserve has lasted for so long now, is that they have politicians in Washington, D.C., turning a blind eye to the inherent inflationary modus operandi of this institution, and they allow it to perpetuate itself upon the American people. Stan, are you still there? Hello, Stan? Stan, if you're still there, I'm going to hang up. You guys have to call me back.
Andre?
Yes.
Okay, I'm sorry. I just had to take care of a little business there.
Okay, all right, I had no idea.
All right, I know what the horrible feeling that we actually got a call just saying we were not being picked up in Washington, and we were apparently our satellite was off, and now it's back on again. So we're being heard out all across America.
Absolutely. Well, that's wonderful. I'm glad. I mean, this message really needs to get out. People need to understand that the Federal Reserve and the privatization of our monetary policy is the root cause of virtually every social, economic, and political malady that America is subject to right now. It can all be traced back to the money.
And I think that's really so vitally important. And people have to understand this: these ideas, these schemes have been tried many, many times before. Ancient Greece, ancient Rome, they were tried certainly in France in the early 1700s, and the United States at the time of the Revolutionary War. They were tried in France in 1789. They've been tried in Europe many times. They've always failed. They were tried in Germany after the First World War. And now we've accepted this concept here. and it will be the undoing of what was once the land of the free and the home of the
brave. I could not agree with you more, and we're going to begin to see it right now. I think the only anomaly right now in our economy is in the S&P, the financial and energy sectors. I think that when Alan Greenspan drove interest rates down from 9% around that area in the nearly 1990s to 1% in 2004, it has had, you know, it has only created an environment from a global context economically that has created economic growth and job creation overseas, particularly in Asia, and it has had an effect on our country here in America that has been very depressive on job creation and real economic growth. And I think as these rates now begin to rise, until the Fed gets them to around the 4 to 5% level, they're going to increasingly compete with stocks, especially in the high price sector. You know, you start looking at companies like Amazon.com, Cirrus, Overstock, Google, eBay, all these must-own stocks right now. I think that the higher price stocks are going to be particularly vulnerable. Every time the Fed raises these interest rates, stocks and investing in general slows down. So I think ultimately we're going to see no soft landing as a result of this new policy of restriction that's coming out by the Federal Reserve. And they really are not able to control the business cycle in a way that's going to be non-disruptive in our economy. It's always very disruptive. It always has the mania of the business cycle is getting more and more volatile as time goes on. And this is a serious problem. So we're going to see the stocks get hit. We're going to see junk bonds right now, which are extremely vulnerable. As the Fed, you know, cut rates down to 1%, I mean, you know, people took refuge in a lot of these risky junk bonds. Now that the pendulum is swinging back the other way, you know, about 98, 75% of all the junk bonds have defaulted. Then on top of that, the real estate bubble is going to be affected, and the people need to know where to take shelter right now. And it's getting harder and harder and harder for Americans to keep their necks out of the water as the Fed begins to raise interest rates and restrict the money supply. So,
well, I think the most interesting thing, it was an article up on the Internet. It was written by the professor of economics, chairman of the department at Brooklyn College, who pointed out that the stock market is manipulated. The price of gold and silver are manipulated. The government is doing things which, if you or I were to try to do them, we'd go to prison for. But nothing is as it appears to be. Everything is being manipulated to create the perception that good times are still going on. And yet, of course, General Motors, certainly the flagship of American industries, their bonds now are just one level above junk bonds.
That is correct.
And General Motors is not going to be around that much longer. They're going to be destroyed by the wave of incoming Chinese and the foreign automobile production they can't possibly compete with. And when General Motors goes, and most of our steel is gone, and certainly most of our heavy industry is gone, even a lot of our electronics and our computer industry is gone. China just bought up the IBM PC business. I don't think the average American understands that at the present time we are exporting the wealth of the American people, and the wealth not only of the current generation but of future generations.
I agree with you wholeheartedly. I think that we will see an influx of automobiles coming in from China. I do think that GM is going to be in serious trouble. They're already in serious trouble. As you said, their stock is only one notch above junk status right now. And the only solution for GM's future is a Fed bailout, much like we had to bail out Amtrak in the 1970s, and much like we had to bail out the airline industry, and like the mortgage industry is going to end up having to be bailed out if they're going to survive.
But the only trouble is, where are we going to get the money? Why, the government doesn't have any money.
They're going to borrow it.
Borrow the money. And of course, as they do that, the value of everybody's currency, everybody's savings, everybody's annuities, pension funds, their future and their children's future is destroyed. We're going to be back here in just a moment with Andre and his book, Thieves in the Temple. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening is Andre Eggleston and his book, Thieves in the Temple. And Andre, you have your own radio program, don't you?
Absolutely. I broadcast every day, Monday through Friday, from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on WSRF.com. That's S as in Sam, R as in Ralph, F as in Frank. .com, WSRF.com, 5 days a week from 11 till 1. And again on Monday nights from 7 till 9 p.m. on WSRF.com. And those are Eastern Standard Times, and we try to keep important topics at the forefront of our agenda, you know, for every single show. And we're trying to make a difference here. It's tough because the American people just have no clue as to, you know, the jeopardy that the dollar is, and along with it, the potential to pass along a prosperous America to our children.
And I agree with you totally. And, Chris, you get into your book a lot about, well, the Rockefeller dynasty and these various organizations working behind the scenes. Do you want to briefly touch on those? Because most people do not understand the power that so few people have here in this country.
I agree with you. The Rockefeller family, as most of us know, basically, they created Standard Oil of New Jersey at the turn of the century, and they got the world off onto a petroleum-based paradigm, and they sold their oil to both sides of World War II, during both sides. As a matter of fact, when we look at our petroleum policy in America, most people fail to remember that before and during World War II, America was the world's supplier of oil. And then Roosevelt quickly realized that we could not sustain this, so he cut a deal with the Saudi royals and decided to use the Saudis as a surrogate oil supplier for the world in exchange for our protecting the Saudi royals from their enemies. And this has gone on and on and on and on for now since 1945, and through various presidential doctrines, we have decided that we will protect the oil interests in the Middle East by any means necessary. And this is why America has such an interjected presence in the Middle East in terms of foreign policy and the development of that part of the world, is because we depend upon them as a surrogate for oil production around the world. And it's only going to lead us to more war, and more costs in terms of being able to acquire energy around the world, both militarily and economically here at home for the consumer.
And, of course, what they have effectively done is block any efforts of oil exploration up in Alaska. They've prevented us from developing any nuclear power plants. And who did this? Why, the environmentalists. Who financed the environmentalists? Why, the great corporations, and you could trace an awful lot of those right back to the very doorstep of the Rockefellers. So they create the problem, they create our energy dependence upon others, and then, of course, that really justifies our going to war in the Middle East.
Absolutely.
And this is what the average American really doesn't understand. And so we're going to be back here in just a moment with Andre, and we're going to be talking about his book, Thieves in the Temple, and we're going to let Andre tell you how you can get copies of it. It's a fascinating book. The more books you read on what's happening economically, why, the better it's going to be for your understanding and your preparation for what I believe are the very, very difficult financial times that will be here very, very soon. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and our guest this evening is Andre Eggleston, and we're talking about his book, Thieves in the Temple. Andre, how can people get your copies of your book?
Well, you can call my publisher directly at Milligan Books in California, and the toll-free number is 877-962-6657. Again, that's 877-962-6657. The book is only $14.95. Or you can log on to Amazon.com and type in Thieves in the Temple and order a copy of it. And they'll get that copy out to you within 24 hours. It will ship from Amazon.com. And I strongly urge everybody to get a copy of the book and, you know, get one for your pastor, get one for your friends, and encourage people to spread this message. because it's the only way we're going to save this country. It's the only way we're going to avoid being guilty by our children's own ultimate characterization of being fiscal child abusers. The Greatest Generation would never have done to us what we are going to do to our children if we allow this debt machine, the Federal Reserve, to continue to exist. We need to join with Ron Paul and the others around the country that have called for nationalizing our central bank and restoring the constitutional mandates of monetary policy.
Now, is that the Chris Mulligan that produced your book?
No, my publisher's name is Dr. Rosie Milligan.
All right, Milligan, okay.
Yes, Milligan, M-I-L-L-I-G-A-N, Milligan Books in Los Angeles. And again, their number is 877-962-6657.
Well, it's an excellent book. It's well written, and it certainly covers the material that you need to know, the factors that led us to where we are and how this whole thing ties together with the wars that have been created. And, of course, one purpose of war is to create debt and, of course, make the people here indebted. And it's really so interesting that they've recently passed new bankruptcy legislation. Now, in the past, you could just, if you got into trouble, why, you could simply write off your debts. Now, you don't go bankrupt, and that was the end of it. They're not going to allow that now, are they, Andre?
No, they don't. I mean, they're not. They're going to end up confiscating people's property and not allowing you to file bankruptcy. And you're absolutely right. War is the greatest generator of debt that the world has ever known. And people have to understand that, you know, we just sold a fleet of F-16s to Pakistan. Now, it's no secret we've been militarizing India for quite some time. Now, we're doing this. We're financing both sides of a regional conflict under the guise of trying to maintain strategic stability within the region. Their idea is that if one side becomes too powerful, then it will invade its neighbor and war could break out. I think it's totally ludicrous. I think that it's crazy to continue to militarize both sides just so that our military hardware manufacturers can make money and the banks can make money financing the whole thing, and people end up suffering around the world. And we don't have any regard for human capital either, Stan. I mean, we take a look at the death and the misery and the disease that is gripping the developing world. It's totally, totally unacceptable. We must have some regard for an investment in human capital and not continue to have a economic world order that's built upon perpetuating war. It's dangerous, and ultimately America, I think, could end up getting hurt if we continue in this way.
Well, I have no question at all. You're absolutely right. And, you know, everybody thinks that, you know, well, we're going to win this war. It's just a matter of time. Well, of course, I wouldn't be too certain we're going to win this war. And I personally believe that there are spiritual forces at work. And if God is just, why, he's going to bring, I believe, a terrible, terrible retribution on this country. Now, you certainly go into a lot of the background of this Federal Reserve system. Certainly there have been people who've spoken out many times against our Federal Reserve system, like Louis McFadden and certainly Wright Patman and Henry Gonzalez. They were all the chairman of the House Banking Committee. They understood the scam. They were congressmen. They tried to reach the American people. And they, of course, were vilified and demonized by the controlled media. And I don't think that as a result of the control of the media, that the average individual has any idea of the history of what has really transpired financially in this country over the last 80 years or so since the Federal Reserve was actually established in 1913. Well, that's 92 years now. Yep. 92 years of betrayal. So when we get back, I'm going to ask Andre to sort of give us a rundown of the background of the history of the Federal Reserve System, how it came about, and then, of course, how we got to the sad, tragic situation where we are today. The system would work if they would simply act responsibly. They would allow the economy to contract at times. But, of course, you can't continue creating debt over a period of 93 years. Without eventually, of course, the time to pay the piper will be upon it. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Andre, why don't you go ahead and just sort of give our listeners just the background, the history of how we got to where we are today.
Well, the history of how we got to where we are today is a long and sad story. First of all, it all goes back to the pre-revolutionary colonies. You'd have to go back to Europe beyond that to trace the evolution of privately owned central banks. But the pre-revolutionary colonies, America was still very poor, and they didn't have sufficient metal coins to pay their taxes. So because commodity money was very difficult to implement as a financial instrument in America at that particular time, just as it would be today, commodity money being silver or gold because of its scarcity, the colonies decided to use colonial script. It was paper money that they printed. They created just enough of it to facilitate trade. They did not hyperinflate the money supply the way the Federal Reserve has done, and it worked really, really well. And England then, through the Currency Act of 1764, forbade the colonies from paying their taxes in anything but gold and silver. This was the prime cause of the Revolutionary War. So we came on down through three separate failed experiments with privately owned central banks. The first was the Bank of North America that was chartered for 2 years, from 1781 to 1783. It was established by a very wealthy member of Congress by the name of Robert Morris. He was a Philadelphia banker. He was considered the financial wizard of Congress. Well, he almost bankrupted America in 2 little years. George Washington ended up saying, you know, now a wagon load of money will scarcely purchase a wagon load of provisions, because at that particular time, Congress made the same mistake that we made in 1913. They gave the Bank of North America the right to print money out of nothing at all, and they hyperinflated the money supply. So we had another privately owned central bank that was set up after that one in 1794, and it lasted for 20 years until 1814. That was the first bank of the United States. And it was pretty much established by Alexander Hamilton, who at that time was the Secretary of the Treasury, and he was a former aide to Robert Morris. Benjamin Franklin ended up saying that if the American people ever allow private banks to control the issue of currency, first by inflation, then by deflation, the banks and corporations that grow up around them will deprive the people of all their property until their children wake up homeless on the continent that their fathers conquered. He also went on to say that a private central bank issuing public currency is a greater menace to our liberties than a standing army. We must not let our rulers load us with perpetual debt.
Hold that thought for just a minute as we bring our stations back. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Andre has been actually giving us the background of the banking system here in America. How initially, of course, we had the continental currency that financed the Civil War, and then we just about bankrupted the country, because you can't print money and simply use it as script. There's got to be something behind it. As Andre quotes George Washington and said, now a wagon full of money will now hardly buy a wagon full of provisions. And then, of course, we went into the first Bank of the United States, and of course that was done away with around the time of the War of 1812. And so you pick up the story from there, because I wish all of our listeners could have heard Andre's presentation, because he's right on. This has been tried over and over and over again. Would you mind giving those quotations from Benjamin Franklin just once more, so that our listeners all across America could hear them? Because I think what Benjamin Franklin said was so absolutely true to what's going on today. Would you mind giving those two quotations?
Absolutely. Well, Benjamin Franklin, I mean, when he was summoned to England to give an account for the prosperity and the colonies that colonial script had brought to the colonies, he told them, he said, look, that's simple. In the colonies, we have our own money. It's called colonial script. We print only enough of it to make the goods pass easily from the producers to the consumers. In this way, we don't have a debt attached. Well, then now the Bank of England wanted the colonies to begin to pay their money, I mean their taxes, in commodity money, gold and silver. Because of the scarcity of it, war broke out. We didn't have enough gold and silver here in America to pay our taxes, and this was the prime cause of the Revolutionary War, according to Benjamin Franklin. Then we had the Bank of North America, established in 1781. It was given a 2-year charter. It was ran by Robert Morris, who was a Philadelphia member of Congress. He was considered the wizard of Congress in matters of finance. He bankrupted the country, and Washington, as you said, ended up saying, a wagon load of money now will scarcely purchase a wagon load of provisions, because Congress gave this privately owned central bank the power to issue money out of nothing at all, just like the Federal Reserve does today. Washington went on to say that one day we might become a great commercial nation and a flourishing nation, but if in the pursuit of the means we should unfortunately stumble again upon unfunded paper money or any similar species of fraud, we shall surely give a fatal stab to our national credit in its infancy. Then finally we ended up getting another privately owned central bank in 1794. It was called the First Bank of the United States. It was created largely by Alexander Hamilton, who at that time was Treasury Secretary. Now, the Hamiltonians and the Jeffersonians, as we remember our history, they went back and forth. Hamilton believed that America would one day be a great industrialized society. Jefferson could only see America as a agricultural-based society. Jefferson said that if the American people ever allow private banks to control the issue of our currency, first by inflation, then by deflation, the banks and the corporations that grow up around them will deprive the people of all their property until their children wake up homeless on the continent that their fathers conquered. He went on to say that a privately owned central bank issuing the public's currency is a greater menace to the liberties of the people than a standing army. We must not let our leaders load us with perpetual debt. Now, by the time that bank reached the end of its charter, the First Bank of the United States, it was a second failure in an experiment with privately owned central banks. The people began to ask for their gold instead of the paper money. And remember, these banknotes were not forced on the people by the government as legal tender law. Still, the bank was able to become the ultimate instrument of plutocracy, and it robbed the American people out of 66% of their wealth, on top of the 42% that Americans lost in the Bank of North America, our first failed experiment with a privately owned central bank. And finally, in 1816, we ended up with our third privately owned central bank. It was given a 20-year charter, and it was ended up being killed by Andrew Jackson, who said that controlling our currency, receiving our public monies, and holding thousands of our citizens in independence, it would be more formidable and dangerous than a naval and military power of the enemy. Nicholas Biddle, who ran the third failed experiment with a privately owned central bank in America, almost bankrupted and destroyed America. Andrew Jackson ended up saying, "You're a den of vipers. I intend to rout you out by the eternal God. I will rout you out." There were two assassination attempts against Andrew Jackson because of his opposition to the bank. And indeed, if you will visit Andrew Jackson's grave, I believe he's buried at the Hermitage, if you will visit his grave, inscribed on his tombstone is, "I kill the bank." The phrase, "I kill the bank." So it's amazing how we have forgotten our lessons of history, how that privately owned central banks have almost destroyed America and allowed for the last 91 and a half years another privately owned central bank to do the same thing to this country that the three privately owned central banks prior to the Federal Reserve have already done to this country. We need to learn our lessons from history. You know, commodity money, granted, it's not going to work. Only 2% of all the gold that was in the vaults beneath the World Trade Centers was actually owned by America, and Fort Knox has never been audited. The Federal Reserve has never been audited, so it's doubtful that a return to a commodity money, or gold and silver specifically as money, would work. We can return to fractional money, wherein our money is partially backed by gold and silver, but fractional money always degenerates to fiat money, which is money that's totally unbacked by gold and silver. So we have a problem because we have allowed this privately owned money machine to become so entrenched in our society, so entrenched in our economy, that uprooting it is going to create global economic chaos. Nevertheless, I agree with Ron Paul, the representative from Texas, Republican. It should be phased out over time. We need to get rid of the Federal Reserve. There's no other way around it. Even if we forgave every one of their debt around the world, if we forgave all Americans of their debt and gave everybody $10,000 to put in their bank account and left the privately owned Federal Reserve in place, it would enslave the country again inside of a generation.
And I really think what's really so amazing is that most of the countries of the world are holding their currency reserves about 80% of their currency reserves are in U.S. dollars, which are worth absolutely nothing other than the integrity and the honesty and the honor of the American government. And I think that as we see, you know, how honest our government is, how courageous our government is, I think you have to realize, of course, that countries throughout the world are wondering how they're going to get out of the dollar. Everybody wants to know how to get out of the dollar. They're afraid to dump them for fear there'll be a run on the dollar, and they'll remaining money they have will simply become worthless. But sooner or later, people are going to start dumping dollars. Why? Because the value has fallen almost 50% over the last five or six years, and so if they had their money invested in dollars, they've lost 50% of their investment. And right now, I think everything is being kept up artificially. We are being propped up not by what we're doing, but by other banks throughout the world who fear the American economy will collapse and they'll be left holding worthless money. And yet, sooner or later, I feel that they're going to be left holding worthless money. And I think everybody knows that. The World Bank, the International Monetary Fund, world leaders are talking about this and wondering how we're going to get out of this mess without the whole world economy beginning to contract. And I fear that this is going to have to happen whether we want to or not. It's going to bring on terrible suffering. But until we get back to a solid monetary base, there will be no freedom in America. Would you agree or disagree with that?
I totally agree with that. I mean, there's only so long we're going to be able to keep the world, and there's only so long that the world is going to be willing to hold dollars, especially when the dollar is being pretty much destroyed by its devaluation against the euro and other hard currencies around the world, if for no other reason than for diversification. Many of these countries, and primarily Asia, are going to begin to opt for another reserve currency. I think it was Paul Sarbanes at Condoleezza Rice's confirmation hearings to become Secretary of State that said, never before has the guardian of the world's reserve currency become its greatest debtor. And this is shocking, it's very frightening, because I can tell you, this has national security implications. You know, the United States does not have any real leverage around the world from a diplomatic standpoint. That's why we have to use our military so wantonly around the world. And contrary to popular opinion, now, even Clinton used the military more than every other president in U.S. history combined in order to gerrymander the geopolitical complexion of the world. And President Bush is doing it on a scale, granted, that's probably a little bit more intense than what Clinton did with the unilateral invasion of Iraq for, you know, false pretenses. You know, what we did in Central Asia was for humanitarian purposes, and it was never purported to be anything otherwise. But the point of the matter is, both sides of the aisle have to use military force in order to expand America's hegemony, because the dollar that used to make America the world's beacon of freedom and prosperity has lost its dominance, has lost its luster, and you're absolutely right. Eventually, these countries are going to opt out of the dollar, if for no other reason than for diversification. But I can tell you that there are a lot of strategic incentives for China and other countries to begin a momentum away from the dollar, not to mention the Middle East. I mean, it would be much more profitable for OPEC and the rest of the oil surrogates around the world to begin to price oil in euros rather than price them in dollars. It would be a windfall in profits for these countries, but it would be a death knell for the American economy.
I agree with you totally. Well, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. So let's go to Roger in Pennsylvania. Roger, do you have a question for our guest?
Yeah, just a quick one that's been making my brain hurt a lot lately, and that is, am I correct that the problem with fractional reservism is not it per se, but without which no loans could be made at all, but rather the obscenely low reserve requirements that allow them to expand that money supply?
Thank you so much. Do you want to take that answer on the air?
Yes. I would agree with that. First of all, there's so much debt and so much credit out there that to say that we can totally eliminate fractional reserve banking overnight is disingenuous. It can't be done overnight. I agree with Ron Paul in that aspect. But they can increase the reserve ratio requirement. Right now, the reserve ratio requirement can be moved to zero, which means banks can just create money based upon no reserves at all. And this is a hyperinflative a dynamic by which these banks are operating, and this is unacceptable. There needs to be more austerity imposed on the banks themselves. I mean, our bank, the international lending institutions, want to impose a very draconian austerity on developing countries who seek our assistance in building a better way of life for themselves, but then the banks themselves will not accept any austerity for their lending practices, and it's just totally wrong. They should not be allowed to hyperinflate America's money supply along with every other country's money supply around the world and end up destroying the world's economy. But that's exactly what they're doing.
And I would simply add that, for instance, you want to go into a bank and you want to borrow money on a house. And so you go and you borrow money. Now, the bank doesn't have any money there. They simply they create the money, the credit, out of nothing. They give you a credit in the bank, and you can borrow them, take the money out. But most people aren't going to take the money out. But now you've borrowed $100,000, say, to buy the house. That house becomes the collateral for the money they've created out of nothing. And then they have the audacity to charge you interest on that money. It's the greatest scam in the world. It's very profitable for the banks, and of course it impoverishes the people. Well, we've got a lady calling, and do you have a question for our guest?
Just quickly, what does he recommend people do to protect their money, like in the bank or in a retirement account?
All right, so do you have any suggestion for what people should do to try to protect themselves if you have a retirement account, something of that?
That is a very, very good question. I think that the markets right now are skewed with tremendous risk. A lot of people are opting to invest in euros on the currency exchange markets, especially now that computers are now powerful enough and programs are out there that would allow people to trade currency. I would also suggest that people buy gold, with cash, either in Canada or some other country to avoid potential confiscation here in America. Keep your gold, keep your precious metals outside of the United States. Also, pension plans can be forced by the government into a kind of backdoor confiscation through the mandatory zero coupon or 30 or 40 year treasuries and end up being inflated away. So I think that the talking eggheads with these financial shows, you know, they've been increasingly wrong in giving these rosy outlooks on the economy since 2000. I mean, these guys are nothing more than Wall Street cheerleaders. You got to remember one thing also, that a lot of people are still pumping money into securities. Be very, very careful, because securities are at the crest of a wave right now. And as securities generally begin to go down, commodities go up. You can invest in the commodities that are going to be the prerequisite for development of other countries, particularly Asia. Right now, Asia is using up about 40% of the world's coal. They're using anywhere between 31 to 25% of the world's steel, its iron and its aluminum, and 70% of the world's crude. And according to Goldman Sachs, in 10 years, China's consumption of these commodities is going to outstretch the world's ability to produce them. And according to Goldman Sachs, again, in 40 years, China will overtake the United States as the world's largest economy. So, you know, but keep in mind, you're financing our own suicide here in America, but there's almost little other alternatives. Get out of debt as quickly as you can, and live within your means. Don't spend yourself into a hole, because the dollar is toast and we're heading for economic problems in this country today. So we can invest in the commodities that are a requisite for China's industrialization, and I think it's a no-brainer. I think we're still in the very early stages of a bull market in the energy sector. Even Goldman Sachs forecasted a potential spike in energy prices that could send the price of crude oil to over $100 a barrel. So, you know, these are what we should be looking into. We should be looking at commodities right now and less at these securities, because, you know, like I said, these overpriced stocks, your overstock.com and, you know, all these other overpriced stocks, they're at the top of a crest, and there's nowhere for them to go right now but down. And as securities go down, historically, commodities go up.
And that's everything Andre says is true, but do not invest in leveraged commodities. The commodity market, you know, if you get in there, this is a great way to make a small fortune out of a large fortune. When we have a solid currency, this is the time to invest and speculate. When you have an insoluble currency, when you have a currency like we have now with nothing behind it, why, you want to be in things, and this is really what Andre is saying. Be in material things, diversified. And, you know, we're going to lose, I honestly believe, most of what we have materially. But all we can do is just try to preserve. See what Warren Buffett is doing. What's he doing? Why, he's invested. He has $19 billion invested out of this country, actually over $20 billion now, and he's in commodities. He's shorting the dollar. You'll find that Bill Gates is out of the country. George Soros is taking their money out of the country. These people are a lot smarter than I am, and they know what's going to happen. So keep listening to our program, and we have some excellent programs on this. And then in the final analysis, you're going to have to decide. Thanks very much for calling.
Thank you. Bye.
Well, this is Dr. Stan, and once again, we've got 3 minutes here before we have to let Andre go. So, Andre, you've got 3 minutes to wrap up the program here.
Well, I want to strongly encourage everybody to get a copy of my book, Thieves in the Temple, America Under the Federal Reserve System. This book, in my opinion, is a must-read. You have to get a copy of this book and understand the history of monetary science and how that America has been negatively affected by its history of experimenting with privately owned central banks. This book will also tell you where we're going in the future. I talk about the rise of stateless capital, the bull run of the 1990s, and the period of corporate scandals, and why there is such a great gulf between the boardroom and the mailroom in corporate America. And it's a system of privately owned central banks that have enabled this evaporation of the middle class and the rise of a sweepingly wide class of poor people in our society that's growing larger and larger every day. Thieves in the Temple, America and the Federal Reserve System. Log on to Amazon.com. You can pick up a copy, or you can order it directly from my publisher, Milligan Books, at area code 877-962-6657. That's a toll-free call, 877-962-6657. Thieves in the Temple, America under the Federal Reserve System.
And
thank you.
And I think it's an excellent book. It really gives you a bird's eye view of really what's going on today. And you know, I've got books, you know, that three or four volumes, and I look at them. I'd love to read them. I'm never going to read those. I don't have the time. This is an easy book to read, and of course, it's got the important things that you need to begin thinking about. And no matter what you're doing now, you have to begin saying, you know, what will happen if the value of the currency goes down? I'm invested in a pension fund, and they're invested in the stock market. What's going to happen to the the value of my pension fund? Well, it's going to go down with the stock market. And if you think that the government's going to be able to come in and rescue you and provide for you from the cradle to the grave, I think that you're living in a false world, because it's the very people you're looking to help you who created the problem we're in today. And believe me, when push comes to shove, why, they're not going to be looking after you. Well, Andre, I really want to thank you so very much for being our guest here at Radio Liberty. I want to thank you for writing the book, Thieves in the Temple, America Under the Federal Reserve System, because it's so vitally important for people to understand the greatest scam of our time, and that is the Federal Reserve is a federal organization, as you say so well. It isn't any more federal than Federal Express. Thank you so very much for being with us.
Thank you, Stan, and I appreciate it.
God bless you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Okay, fine. Well, that, I guess, has been Andre Engelstrom, and we'll be right back in a moment here. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and, of course, our guest has been Andre Engelstrom, and we're talking about his book, Thieves in the Temple, and an understanding of what's happening financially is so vitally important. And we actually have a couple of newsletters in my September and October 2004 newsletters are available at our website at RadioLiberty.com, which will give you an overview of the whole financial scam, and it is a scam. The only trouble is, of course, it scammed the entire American people. And the future of our economy, the future of our senior citizens, everything is hung and dependent upon the stability of paper money. That, of course, in many instances, is not worth the money paper that it's printed on. So you need to understand the background of what's going on. Certainly, we carry several books, and one of them would be The Creature from Jekyll Island. The Creature from Jekyll Island, a great book, easy to read, and gives you the entire background of the secret meetings that were held on Jekyll Island back in 1910, where a group of very wealthy men, people like Nelson Aldrich, for whom Nelson Aldrich Rockefeller was named, and Paul Warburg, and so many of the other people tied into J.P. Morgan and the Rockefeller interests, sat down and figured out how they would scam the American people into accepting a privately owned central bank that would hold their future in private hands, and they came up with the idea of something called the Federal Reserve. And the people then would think it had to do with the government, and the government was going to take power away from the banks, and it was just exactly the opposite. The government was going to turn power over to the very banks that had been exploiting the people and creating booms and busts repeatedly, and every time there was a bust, poor people lost their property, of course, it was taken over by the people of great wealth. It's unfortunate, but there really are scoundrels out there, and this has happened time and again down throughout history. Well, the Federal Reserve is the longest-running scam in this country, but it is a scam. We have a book called The Federal Reserve Conspiracy. It's a very short book written by our good friend Professor Sutton, Andrew Sutton, Anthony Sutton, before he passed away. We have two of his books. One is Gold for Survival. The other is Gold for Investment by Professor Sutton. We have the book Fiat Money Inflation in France. That's Fiat Money Inflation in France. And, of course, we have a video called The Phenomenon, The Monopoly Men. And all of these, of course, will give you the overall story of what's going on. But if you'd like, of course, to get my newsletters, they're free up on the Internet. That is September and October of 2004. Or if you get any of the books we've talked about, we'll be glad to send you those newsletters if you specifically request them. That's September and October of last year, that will give you an overview not only of what's happening economically from a historical point of view and from a practical point of view, but from a spiritual point of view, because you can't understand anything unless you understand the spiritual forces that are at work in our society today. Well, remember our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. Our website is RadioLiberty.com. If you'd like a free copy of one of our newsletters, we can send you either the September or October newsletter. And if you already have them, I suggest the November newsletter, which will give you an excellent overview of the fluoride situation, where we're poisoning, destroying the minds of our children and destroying the adults in this country. Another great scam. And of course, the November newsletter begins to introduce you to how they're poisoning the American people, and they know exactly what they're doing. Do you know a better way to destroy this nation than to poison our people? Why is cancer on the rise? Why is heart disease on the rise? Why is autism on the rise? Why is allergy on the rise and asthma on the rise? And do you think those things are all happening by accident? Well, pray for America. Pray for revival. Pray for our leaders and our ministers. But please pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and protection. Remember our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927. And we'll be back in just a few moments with the second hour here at Radio Liberty. Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you, the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and of course we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY, that's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the central coast of California at 464-8295, but please hold your calls for the time being, or at least until the half hour. We have with us Lorraine Johnson, and we're going to be talking about Lyme disease. And I think it's so important that people really understand that we have probably a million, maybe more than that, Americans that have this entirely new disease. Where did it come from? Well, nobody really wants to ask that question. We have about a million people, or close to a million people, with chronic fatigue syndrome and fibromyalgia. And, of course, these people are totally disabled. And it doesn't appear that the Centers for Disease Control in Atlanta, Georgia, is very interested in either one of these terrible disabling diseases. But, oh boy, if you have some rare congenital abnormality, they'll spend unlimited amounts of money to get to the bottom of that. So the question comes up, what is Lyme disease? What do people then do when they have Lyme disease? And one of the things that Lorraine does is she deals with the problem that people face trying to obtain medical care for their Lyme disease, because a lot of the insurance companies just don't want to pay for that. Would that be a fair statement, Lorraine?
That's certainly a fair statement.
Why don't you tell our listeners just a little bit about who you are, how you happen to get involved in this?
Well, my name is Lorraine Johnson, and my background is that I'm an attorney, and for years I practiced within the entertainment industry, practicing corporate law, but eventually I became very ill, and when I became ill, it took 8 years for me to get an accurate diagnosis of Lyme disease. I was misdiagnosed for 8 years with depression, and they tried me on a number of different psychotropic medications. I think I went through 52 different drug trials, and nothing was working. But when I would suggest that perhaps they should do some physical tests on me, maybe they should draw some blood to see if I had an infection going on of some sort, I was told it wasn't necessary. You know, that's sort of the way that psychiatry operates. So it took me a long time to get an accurate diagnosis. It was 8 years for me.
Now, that's it's such a disheartening thing, but when you know that it's not, you know, your emotions, and yet everybody keeps telling you, and then you begin to sort of wonder, well, maybe really I am crazy or depressed, or there's something wrong with me. And, of course, many people are aware this is a real physical illness, and nobody wants to admit it. After all, what's the old saying, you know, when you got a hammer and a nail, why usually want to drive it? Well, you're a psychiatrist, you know, you want to think it's a psychiatric disease.
Mm-hmm. I think that's true. And I do think that there is a real problem, that when you have a condition that looks like depression, or that looks like a bipolar illness, or that looks like OCD, that there aren't physical tests done, that doctors don't do the differential diagnosis. It's really critical that patients, I think, become self-advocates and make sure that all of the possibilities have been exhausted before they relegate themselves to just continual drug trials.
Well, I'll tell you what, Lorraine, I practiced medicine for many years, and I can remember one time saying to a patient, why don't you go see somebody else? I'm not doing any good. And she said, well, you're going to get to the bottom of this one day. And eventually I did, but it took me a couple of years to do it. Mm-hmm. We'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening is Lorraine Johnson, a practicing attorney. But, of course, she's going to be talking about the plight that people with Lyme disease have. You know, first of all, not only getting a diagnosis, but then, of course, getting adequate treatment for it. Because, first of all, there aren't very many doctors. And then, a lot of times, the insurance companies don't want to pay for treatment. So, why don't you pick up the story from there, Lorraine?
Well, yes, the insurance companies are a real problem. I mean, what happened, you know, it was maybe about 30 years ago, 20 years ago, insurance companies started being covered by managed care. You know, managed care entered into the, you know, the medical arena, and that changed how medicine was delivered to people. So that if you had an illness that was discovered before managed care became very entrenched, you had time for doctors to try out different therapies, to figure out what worked, and ultimately to, you know, decide on a course of treatment. I mean, most of our illnesses were decided in that type of an environment. But when managed care became involved in medicine, what happened was there was an extreme emphasis placed on evidence. And the natural process of the physician and the patient working through and trying different alternatives was subverted, because the insurance companies started saying, well, you can't try that alternative unless you have evidence in advance that it works. So that became a real problem for people who have diseases that were discovered, you know, in the last 20, 30 years, like Lyme was.
And I think the other thing about managed care, at least if you're on an HMO, why, if you have a well patient, you get well paid because he's not going to take any of your time. If you have a sick patient, why, of course, many times the doctors have to pay for the test or the detracted, or if they're going to get a consultation, it's taken out of their pay. And so there's a disincentive in the health maintenance organization to take care of patients. One reason I was anxious to get out of medicine is I did not go to medical school and take my residency to learn how to deprive people of medical care, and that is the philosophy of HMOs. No matter how they want to phrase it over here about, you know, preventive medicine, we really want to take care of you. We want healthy patients. That's it. They want healthy patients. But if you are sick, you are a drag on them, and you're going to cost them money. Now, there are a few, of course, of the larger healthcare maintenance organizations that may not be the underlying motivation, but believe me, I will tell you that I was associated with many of those in practice. And the people who brought this all about, the people in government, they don't have HMOs. The people in Congress, they don't have HMOs for themselves or their families, but they determine that you're going to have HMOs for yourself and for your family. And believe me, that's second-class medicine. We'll be right back here. Well, I guess this evening is Lorraine Johnson, who's an attorney, and of course she became very, very concerned about how people who have these chronic diseases, such as Lyme disease, are going to be able to get their health care. And she pointed out that since we've had HMOs being implemented in medicine, they really came in 1980, 1981, I remember, because I was a member of the House of Delegates of the California Medical Association at that time and fought them at every turn. Of course, the doctors and the patients were being betrayed by the leaders of organized medicine who were working with the insurance companies to enslave the doctors, but the doctors wouldn't listen when we tried to tell them what was going on under any circumstances. We can't turn the clock back, but it's been 25 years, 24 years now since we had HMOs. And Lorraine's point is that you're not going to be able to do a lot of the things that need to be done with some of these very bizarre illnesses that are very real, and they're caused by a specific type of spirochete. But, of course, the conditions are very hard to diagnose, and sometimes you have to even treat them empirically. So you pick up the story there, Lorraine.
Well, it's an interesting thing, the dynamic that you're talking about with the patient and the doctor, because for so long patients have trusted doctors to operate in the patient's best interest. And doctors were able to do that for so long as they could, you know, be paid for their time. But once managed care became involved, doctors became less able to do that. And there was an inherent conflict of interest between what they needed to do in order to satisfy the HMOs and the managed care organizations and what they needed to do to take care of their patients. And unfortunately, I think that the people who really suffered are the patients in that equation. And that I think is why it's so important for patients to become self-advocates. That if you have a serious chronic illness, it's just critical that you take control of your own health care to make sure that the proper tests are being done and to make sure that your doctor is really operating in your best interest.
What a terrible thing we've deteriorated into. At one time, medicine was a noble profession. I loved it. I was proud to be a doctor. But the way it's becoming today, why, it's all different. Everything has changed, hasn't it?
Yes, it's changed dramatically. There was, you know, when the time was where a patient would go see a doctor and they would try a standard therapy and it didn't work, and then the doctor would say, well, you know, I don't really know what to do next, but let's try this. This just might work. And that was the way that medicine was practiced for a number of years. But that sort of practice, I think, is really in jeopardy now with the managed care organizations. And it's unfortunate because all of your innovation in medicine really comes from that simple question. I don't know what to do here yet. Why don't we try this? And that type of experimentation is really being squashed, I think, by the managed care organizations.
All right, fine. So, well, basically, then, Chris, the other thing is that some of these cases, especially if you have Lyme disease or chronic fatigue syndrome, why, they're very hard to make the diagnosis and be absolutely certain that you've got what you think you have.
Mm-hmm. That's right. They are complex diagnoses, which means that the doctor has to spend a lot more time than managed care organizations want them to. I mean, I think right now the mean amount of time that a doctor is supposed to spend with a patient is 7 minutes. It's very difficult to go through a differential diagnosis, to pay careful attention to the symptoms that a patient may have if it's a complex illness in that amount of time. What you find with the patients who have got Lyme disease, when they go see a Lyme doctor for the first time and they're being diagnosed, generally that visit's going to be an hour or an hour and a half, because it takes that long to take a complete medical history and to understand the multi-systemic types of symptoms that the patient may have.
And I think what's so interesting about this is that, I mean, a lot of doctors say, well, I can make a diagnosis of Lyme disease. Well, if you have a positive blood test and you have, you know, a very obvious physical findings, that's one thing. But so many of these patients, you know, they're in the chronic stage of the disease, and most doctors cannot, of course, make the diagnosis because they've never been taught how to make the diagnosis, and because the CDC has come up with diagnostic criteria that are going to miss the vast majority of the cases of chronic Lyme disease. And then if you follow what the CDC says and what you're being told at your medical meetings, you're going to miss these cases. That's the great tragedy, as far as I'm concerned, because most laboratories don't even really know how to run the tests on these.
Well, it is a real problem, the misunderstanding of how the laboratory test works. I mean, there is roughly 20 to 30% of patients are what they call seronegative, which means that if you draw their blood and if you put it through a standard test, they will come back negative. That's under the best diagnostic test that we have available today. What the CDC wants in terms of its surveillance definition, which is supposed to be just to track diseases, it's not supposed to be for diagnostic purposes, but what they would like for people to do is to first do a test that they call the ELISA test. And the ELISA test is known to miss as many as 50% of the patients. So it's not, and they're using the ELISA test as a screening test, but the ELISA test is not sensitive enough to be used as a screening test. A screening test, you know, you should have 95% or more cases being picked up, not something as low as 50%. So you're, by definition, if you use the ELISA test, which most doctors do because they don't really know any better, you're going to miss 50% of the cases.
And, Chris, well, they're thinking of it as it is with treatment of HIV disease. And there you've got a 99%, 98%, 99% accuracy. You're going to pick up 98%, 99% of the cases with an ELISA test.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, to confirm that, while you do a Western blot, but, I mean, you're pretty sure you're going to get you're not going to miss many cases. Whereas, of course, the ELISA test is used with Lyme disease, you're going to miss half the cases, and that nobody's told the doctors that. And so they don't go ahead and do the Western blot, which is really the confirmatory test. Would that be a fair statement?
That is a fair statement, and I think the point that you're making about the HIV test is important, because I think a lot of doctors just assume that it's going to be the same sort of test with the same sort of results, and it doesn't operate that way with Lyme. But what's interesting about the Western blot is, even with the Western blot, which is our best test today, you're still going to have 20 to 30% of patients will be seronegative. They will test negative on the Western blot, even though they have Lyme disease. And when I say 20 to 30%, I mean, these are patients who are who have got the erythral migraines rash, which is a determinative diagnostic rash. If you have that rash, you, by definition, have Lyme disease. When they take those patients and they put them through the Western blot, 20 to 30% of them will come back negative. So you know that there is a lot that's being missed there in that test. It's a clinical diagnosis, which means, you know, a clinical diagnosis of a complex illness requires an investment of time by the doctors in order to understand the symptoms that the patient has. And primarily, they need to be looking at whether this is a multisystemic illness. You know, for instance, when I was seeing my psychopharmacologist and I was under a diagnosis of depression, they didn't consider the fact that I had arthritis in a knee. That didn't, you know, that wasn't something that entered into the equation. They didn't consider the fact that my cognitive ability was going down. So there's a lot of things that they can be looking at when you see a patient with a multisystemic illness, particularly if it involves anything neurologic. A Lyme diagnosis should be a differential diagnosis.
And, of course, this disease is produced by a spirochete, and it can affect the brain, it can affect the heart, it can affect the liver, it can affect the joints, it can affect literally every organ in your body. And so the patients come in and they get all these complaints, and you know, you say you're almost afraid to ask them if they have any trouble with their stomach or if they have any trouble with their head or if they have any trouble with their lungs, because they got a positive answer for everyone. And then, you know, the doctor just sits there and just says, oh my goodness, you know, nobody could be this ill.
Mm-hmm.
And the trouble is, you can be this ill when you have a systemic disease, and especially when you've got a patient that's gone from doctor to doctor to doctor, and they've always said there's nothing wrong with you, it's all in your head, and pretty soon the patient gets, well, we used to call them pretty squirrely. They give you the impression that they're nervous and tense, and I'd be nervous and tense too if I went from doctor to doctor and nobody could figure out what was wrong with me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it can be disheartening. I think that it requires patients being pretty steadfast in their own belief in themselves and relentlessly pursuing the diagnosis. I know in my case, what I did was I went in and I found a doctor who was willing to work with me, and I asked them to first test my immune system, and they tested it and found it was not good. And I said, okay, so my immune system's not good. Does that mean I have a parasitic infection? Do I have a yeast infection? Do I have a bacterial illness? Do I have a viral illness? What's going on here that's making my immune system suppressed? And then they were willing to go through and run a battery of tests to track that down. But most doctors aren't willing to do that. That requires an investment of time, and particularly if you're being paid on a capitation arrangement with an HMO, you don't have the resources to expend in that fashion. So I think patients really do have to take back their health care, and even if they have to dip into their own pocket, your health is the most important thing, and making sure that you're accurately diagnosed and treated has to be the most important consideration.
Well, of course, the worst thing we ever did was when we got away from the patients paying for their own care. Certainly, you need hospitalization insurance and maybe insurance for major surgery and things like that. But once you begin turning your health care over to the insurance company, why you can be sure the insurance company is really not concerned about you. They're concerned about their bottom line. And that's what's wrong with, of course, when they change the insurance from being hospital and catastrophic insurance to we're going to take care of everything for you. And then pretty soon it gets so expensive, and they've got to get cutting back and restricting and putting pressure on the doctor not to order the tests. And once the doctor is working for the insurance company rather than for the patient, why, you've laid yourself open for the disaster we're in today. Well, we're going to be back here in just a few moments with Lorraine Johnson. We're going to be talking about this disease. That how many people do you think there are out there with Lyme disease today in America, Lorraine?
It's very hard to guess. The CDC reported last year, I believe it was 23,000 people were diagnosed with Lyme disease, and they know that that's an underestimate of at least tenfold.
We'll be back in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest this evening is Lorraine Johnson. We're talking about Lyme disease, and of course, we're talking really about how people are going to get their payment for, how they're going to be able to get their medical care, because this is really what's so difficult, is first of all to find a doctor who knows anything about Lyme disease, what you read in a few of the medical journals and the articles, so much of this is what everybody else knows, but there are doctors that really are specialized in this field. There are about 125, 150 of them across America.
I think it's more like 200.
About 200, but they call them Lyme-literate physicians, and they go to meetings, and they talk about this among themselves, and what works and what doesn't work. And I will tell you that if you are a physician, you're treating these cases, and you're treating them well, of course, you close your practices. So many of these doctors have, because there's so many patients out there desperate to find a doctor who can treat them.
Mm-hmm. That's
pretty sad commentary on medicine today.
Yes, that's true. I wanted to go back for a minute, if I could, to the number of patients with Lyme disease, because I think it's an important question. And the CDC is reporting, I believe it's like 23,000 people annually coming down with Lyme disease. They acknowledge that that's underreporting by tenfold. So that means 230,000 to begin with. But those are people who would meet the CDC surveillance definition, which is very restrictive. There are cases, there was a case study done where they looked at the population in an area and looked at the CDC reporting criteria and compared it with physician diagnosis, and they found that physicians diagnosed Lyme disease 40-fold what the CDC reports were. So you can be looking at a really large number when you start looking at those sort of statistics. You're up at, 800,000 there, and then what happens with prevalence with a disease is it's not how many people come down with it in a given year, but how many people continue to have the disease. And once you get into chronic illness, of course, that will carry over year to year. So, it's anybody's guess, really, how many people are out there affected with Lyme disease. But we believe it's very substantial. We believe it's really under-recognized. And we believe that there are a number of people who are misdiagnosed with MS or ALS, or other Parkinson's, Alzheimer's, other neurologic types of diseases that actually have Lyme disease.
And I think that's really what's rather so frightening about this, is because this is a treatable disease if you recognize it, and you can have the symptoms, because this spirochete can get into the spinal cord and simulate MS or anterior lateral sclerosis. You can get in the brain, the basal ganglia of the brain, and simulate Parkinson's disease. And you have all the signs of it, but of course Parkinson's disease is due to degeneration. This is related to infection of the basal ganglia.
Well, it's interesting because, as I said, in my case, they misdiagnosed me with diagnosis for 8 years. But when I was finally accurately diagnosed, I went in and I got what they call a SPECT scan, which shows how well the blood is getting to the brain. And in my case, the first SPECT scan that they did of me showed that I was getting so little blood to the brain that as a differential diagnosis, they suggested I might have Tick's disease, which is where the frontal lobes start sloughing off. So I was really getting very little blood to the brain, and it didn't take much for a doctor to have figured that out if they had done any diagnostic tests. And then I went on treatment for, I was on 9 months of IV Rocephin.
Hold that thought for just a minute there, right? Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening is Lorraine Johnson. And Lorraine, for 8 long years was trying to get somebody to listen to her, to begin to try to figure out what was wrong with her. And finally, of course, she did find a physician who had figured out what was going on. And she was on Rocephin, which is a very, very powerful antibiotic. Was it 8 months?
I was on it for 9 months.
9 months. And what happened? Was it sort of like this veil was beginning to lift from you as your ability to think? And
It was remarkable because, I had been an attorney before I got ill, and I had watched my mental capacity really dip quite low. So seeing the picture that they took of my brain with the blood flow before my treatment, and then I had the same procedure, the same SPECT scan done after my treatment, was dramatic. I mean, the difference was night and day in terms of how much blood was getting through to the brain. And, if you don't have blood getting through to the brain, you are going to feel depressed. You are literally going to be slowed down in your cognitive thinking and in your ability to respond.
Well, I think it's amazing. And of course, are you back practicing law now?
Right now I'm working as a healthcare advocate within the community, and I'm doing some consulting as well.
All right, fine. And so basically, of course, the big problem is how do people get their treatment? And what about, of course, when you're dealing with an HMO? I mean, how are you going to get the HMO to really do what they should for you?
Mm-hmm.
Because the government has said you can't sue the HMO for depriving you of care. That's the craziest thing in the world. All you can do is sue the doctor, but you can't sue the HMO that prevents the doctor from doing what needs to be done.
Yes.
What sort of madness is this?
Well, it puts a doctor in a real double bind, I think, because the doctor continues to have an obligation of care to the patient. They have to conform to the malpractice standards, which means that they have to exercise a standard of care in their dealings with a patient, but the HMOs don't have the same sort of obligation necessarily. They can in some circumstances, but they don't always have the same obligation. But, you know, it's interesting the point that you raised earlier about how, with the HMOs being involved, how that has interfered with the concept of medicine. Because what happens is, if you were going to say that people, nobody had insurance, medicine would evolve the way that it would evolve, and what worked would work. But when you start getting meddling in it by insurance companies early on, you don't even have the opportunity for the science to unfold the way that it ought to unfold without constraints. And I think that's a real impediment to medicine generally.
I agree with you totally. Well, what are you able to accomplish as an advocate for the people?
Well, what we do is we've spent quite a bit of time and effort working with insurance companies. We're trying to get them to sit down and discuss the evidence base for Lyme disease, which is very difficult because, you know, the problem with the insurance companies when you're trying to get payment is your pennies in their pocket, and they have no incentive for reaching into their own pocket and giving it back to you, particularly the way that the court structure is working right now and so forth. It's just very difficult. When patients are covered by, when their plan is under ERISA, they really have very few rights for going after their insurer. So it makes it very difficult to get the insurance companies to sit down. We've sent them, you know, stacks of information and asked them to sit down with us to discuss the evidence. And it's not uncommon for us to just simply be stonewalled. You know, there's a huge premium that insurance companies place on evidence, but as soon as you provide it to them, they're unwilling to sit down and review it, which should immediately cause people to suspect that it's not really the evidence that this is about.
No, it really has to do with the bottom line. And importantly, insurance companies really are crass. They're not motivated by altruism, although I think that somebody who might work for them might be motivated by altruism. I know people who work for the insurance companies, and they've been told this has nothing to do with right and wrong. It has to do with the bottom line. And so they'll push it just as far as they possibly can until they run into somebody like you.
Well, that's exactly what they do. And so it's important, I think, for people to exercise the rights that they have. I mean, most states, people have got the right to get an independent medical review of their insurance claim if it's denied by their insurer. And it's important for people to take advantage of those rights. When you do that, what happens is that even if you don't succeed, the statistics of your case will be tracked by the state, and that becomes an important factor.
And I really think it's so vitally important that people really understand that you have to get somebody to help you with this, because you're really helpless. Here's you, you know, by yourself and negotiating with a multi-billion-dollar insurance company. Well, forget about it. You don't stand a chance. That's why you need a health advocate, somebody who knows the law, somebody who knows the disease, somebody who understands what's really going on. And I think that's why Lorraine really plays a very important part in obtaining health care for the unfortunate people inflicted with this completely new disease. And where did it come from? Well, we'll be back in just a few minutes here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, our guest this evening, is Lorraine Johnson. We're talking about, of course, Lyme disease and her job as an advocate for the people. Well, are you going back into the practice of law, or are you going to continue doing what you're doing?
I think for right now, I'm going to continue working within the Lyme community as an advocate because there's such a pressing need, and there are so few people who have Lyme disease who are healthy enough to be able to really pitch in and help at the level that I'm able to do it. So I think this, for right now, this is what I'm going to be doing.
Well, I'm glad you are, because I'll tell you what we need is some people who are motivated by altruism and trying to help. We live in a big, unfriendly world out there, and unfortunately, when you're dealing with multi-billion-dollar companies, you need an advocate to help you. What sort of results are you getting when you actually, confront the insurance companies? Are you getting any help from the state insurance boards?
Well, the state insurance boards, you know, it's interesting because you have a right to an independent medical review, but if you ask your state how their independent medical reviews operate, usually what they do is they send the cases off for review by an organization that ordinarily handles insurance claims. So the person that your claim is sent off to is somebody who ordinarily has an insurance hat on. And, you know, people being as they are, they just simply want to do their job efficiently. So they pull out the same old tired precedents that they used for their insurance companies, and they end up using those quite a bit in independent medical reviews. So I think there's a problem throughout the country in terms of the independent medical review system. There's also a problem because in the treatment of Lyme disease, there's significant what they call specialty bias, which means that there's a group of physicians that believe only in short-term treatment, and there's a group of physicians who believe in longer-term treatment. Well, the choice between treatment modalities belongs to the patients, but what frequently happens is the insurance companies will pick and choose the guidelines or the specialty bias that favors them economically. So they'll choose the short-term treatment guidelines, regardless of what the patient has selected. And this, of course, gets in the way of patient autonomy. You know, patients have a right to decide how they're going to be treated medically and what's going to happen with their body. So this is a very large issue within the community, I believe.
And I really think, of course, that I've done medical reviews, you know, asked by the medical society to do that. But, if you don't understand what the issues are, fortunately, I understood what the issues were in the cases I reviewed. But if you don't understand it, if you're an average internist asked to interview a case for Lyme disease, you're going to go by what everybody else is doing. And, of course, you're going to say, well, there's nothing can be done. We'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Lorraine Johnson. We're talking about Lyme disease, and I'm sure there must be close to a million people, maybe many, many more, that have this chronic disease. I talked to a gentleman earlier this evening. He has Lyme disease, been diagnosed by it. He spends 23 hours a day in bed. I mean, he's that weak. He just can't get up and be productive. This has just destroyed his life. Well, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. That's 831-464-8295. If you'd like to call us, you'd like to talk to Lorraine about a very real illness. And we have so many people increasingly ill in our society. And of course, Lyme disease is so confusing because it manifests in so many different ways. And, of course, there is a Lyme disease associations. There are support groups for people with Lyme disease. Do you belong to such a group? Or how can people out there who are, have Lyme disease, who are looking for help or have these chronic conditions and think they might have something like this, where can they get help? Where can they get support? Where can they get information?
Well, I would suggest on a nationwide basis that people contact the Lyme Disease Association. They can be reached. Their URL for their website is www.lymedisease.org. The other group that people can contact, particularly if they're in California, is the California Lyme Disease Association, which is at www.lymedisease.org. And I'm the executive director of the California Lyme Disease Association, and I'm also on the advisory board for the Lyme Disease Association. We work very closely together.
Now, are you associated with this group of a Lyme literate physicians?
I do a lot of work with ILADS. They're very closely connected with a lot of the patient support groups and advocacy groups. You know, it's interesting, there are two sets of guidelines that are out for treating Lyme disease. One was put out by ILADS, which specializes in the treatment of tick-borne diseases, and the other was put out by the Infectious Disease Society, which specializes in infectious diseases and, you know, Lyme disease is like a drop in the bucket, you know, in terms of the areas of expertise that they practice. But interestingly, when the guidelines were put together by ILADS, they consulted with the patients' groups, and so the patients did have a voice and a say in the guidelines. They didn't actually draft them or anything like that, but my point is that they were respected as stakeholders in that decision, whereas in the infectious disease guidelines, the patients were not consulted. It's sort of interesting when you look across the spectrum of other diseases. For instance, with HIV, the amount of inclusion that was included for patients was really pretty profound. Patients were involved in the drafting of the guidelines. They were involved in reviewing the guidelines. They were involved in critiquing the guidelines. But it's difficult for patients to get a place at the table. When you look at who is the most affected by medicine today? It's the patient. And yet it's very difficult for the patients and the patient groups to have a voice in determining the treatment protocols, and yet they're the ones who are the most profoundly affected by them.
Well, let's go to Jeanette, who's calling us from Watsonville. Hi, Jeanette. How are you doing?
Hi. I'm doing fine, Dr. Stan. How are you?
I'm doing fine. Haven't heard from you in a while.
I know, but I've been listening.
I know.
A friend of mine at work has been tested for Lyme disease, and one person says she has, and another person says she doesn't. But she doesn't have a computer at home. Is there a phone number that where she can contact you or to contact someone to talk with?
There isn't a phone number that she could contact. I know that the Lyme Disease Association has a phone number, but I don't have it handy. Maybe I'll be able to. Let me see if I can come up with that while I'm on the air tonight, and when I do find it, to go ahead and give it to Stan so that we can report it out so that other people would have it to call. I believe the Lyme Disease Association does have an 800 number. I just am not aware of it.
Jeanette, of course, if we don't come up with it, why try to get somebody to go up on the Internet and then pull it down. I know, for instance, called, I got on their Internet site, and they said, well, call the number, leave your name, and we'll get back to you. And they did get back to me, and that's how we were able to get Pat Smith, who we had on a couple of about a week ago, and Pat put us in touch with Lorraine. So, but the thing is that there's not a lot of money behind this. Most of the people who have this disease are, you know, by the time they get through being misdiagnosed for years and then getting treated, and it's expensive proposition, they're pretty well impoverished, and the government is not investing money, as they should be in trying to find what can be done here. They're wasting all sorts of money on all sorts of things. But here's a disease that certainly affects a million people, or probably maybe twice that many, and they're not spending any money on it, hardly at all.
Let me give you a number that can be called.
Okay.
This is for the Lyme Disease Association.
Okay.
It is 888-366-6611.
6611.
Right.
Give that one more time.
888-366-6611.
Okay, and then maybe before you're off the air, you give the website addresses again, because I can get on the Internet for her. Hopefully she's listening. I did tell her about your program, but there are some places in Watson where people can't get your station, Dr. Stan, so
I'm afraid that unless she lives over the hills over there, it won't come in here, because she can always hear us on the Internet or on shortwave, but I'm afraid that FM doesn't get in there too well.
No. Thank you.
God bless. Bye-bye.
You too. Bye-bye.
And you want to give those websites once again?
Yes. For the Lyme Disease Association, it's www.lymedisease.association.org. And for the California Lyme Disease Association, it's www.lymedisease.org. lymedisease.org.
All right, fine. So basically, one's Lyme disease, the other's lymedisease.org. Is that
right? That's right.
All right.
There's something that is going on legislatively in California that we believe is going to be passed this week, which is a resolution for Lyme awareness. And that is just something that is critically important because, as you know, there's so little awareness of the problem. Particularly in California, there's a belief that the disease is an East Coast problem, when the fact is that it is throughout most of the counties within California. So it's important for people to be aware of the disease, for them to be aware that when they get a tick bite that they need to be cautious about removing the tick, that they remove it properly, that they not go at it with a match or with a or with Vaseline. You know, it's a tick, you've got to look at it as being like a big hypodermic needle, and if you go and you squeeze its body as you're pulling it out, you've just given yourself an injection.
Well, how do you get it out then?
Well, the way to get it out is you take tweezers right near the very head of the tick and you pull it straight out. It's important that people remove a tick properly. And then if it were me, I would send the tick in to have it tested to make sure that it didn't have any diseases, because ticks can carry not only Lyme disease, but they can carry a number of other diseases. Somebody referred to them as being the cesspools of infectious disease, which is pretty accurate.
And they do. They carry rickettsial diseases. There are many, many diseases you get from ticks. But, you know, we didn't have Lyme disease. It started about, in the probably the late 70s or early 80s,
right,
back in a place called Lyme, Connecticut. And it just gradually spread all across America from there. And it's carried by a tick. Well, let's go to Roger, who's calling us from Pennsylvania. Again, our telephone number, 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. Roger, you have a question for our guest.
Yes, I'm asking, since the best thing would be to, upon the first denial from the HMO or the representative of the doctor, to just rush out and pay, if possible, out of pocket for that speedy diagnosis, then does it preclude lawsuit or threatening lawsuit merely for recovery of cost, not damages or any of that? And or can one, and is it readily possible to convert to an HMO that offers that option to recover what was a proven diagnosis?
Well, I don't know. Let's talk to the lawyer. Thanks so much, Roger. Did you hear Roger's thing? He says...
I think that when, you know, if you go into an HMO and they are not going to do the proper testing for you, I think it's important that you go out and get a prompt diagnosis and prompt treatment. That's the most important thing that you can do for yourself. Because if you delay that while you're doing a fight with your insurance company, you may find yourself with a chronic and potentially less treatable illness. And that can be really devastating. So the most important thing to do when you're sick is to go in, get the correct diagnosis, no matter how you have to do that, whether it's out of network or whatever, and make sure that you're being taken care of in that fashion. Then you turn around and do battle with your insurance company if that's the road that you want to pursue. And I don't think it makes any difference in terms of what ultimately happens, except, of course, you may have less damages. But the reason you may have less damages is because you're more healthy, and that's the most important thing.
And, of course, the thing is that if you don't get this treated right away, it becomes chronic and it gets this hides in the cells there, and you begin to get multiple systems involved. Why, you know, far better off just to get the thing treated, and if you have to pay for it yourself out of pocket, do it. Don't just sit around, figuring how you're going to get even with the insurance company. Why, you're responsible for your own health. And so I hope that answers Roger's question. Roger calling from Pennsylvania. And then, of course, if you want to, once you get cured, to take it up with the insurance company. But believe me, you know, I practiced orthopedic surgery for many years, and I saw so many people get into fights with the insurance companies or fights with somebody else and get them into courts, and, well, they may have ended up getting some money. But it destroyed them. I mean, have you run into that, Lorraine? Sometimes we get so interested in getting into legal battles that we miss sight of what's really all about.
Yeah, I think that happens. And the other thing that I think happens is that people are used to medicine being practiced in a way that was, you know, decent, above board, and ethical. And so when they get a denial from their insurance company, or their insurance company says, we're not going to do a Western blot on you, they say, oh, this must be right. I should listen to them. They know what they're doing. And that's a real mistake today, I think. I think patients today have to be much more aware of what their conditions could be and to make sure that they're being properly diagnosed and treated.
What does a Western blot test cost?
Well, it depends on the lab that does it, but I think that it's about $250.
Well, it's a lot of money, but you're better to put it out and get the diagnosis and get treated if you actually have the disease. And that's really, I think, the best thing you probably will learn from our program this evening. Your health care is your responsibility. Do not put it off on the insurance company, or you may very well live to regret it.
Mm-hmm.
Again, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. And of course, the problem that people have is the fact that, you know, they expect somebody else to look after them, and nobody's going to look after you. And even if you've got a doctor who really wants to do it right, when he's trapped in this system, it's extremely difficult for him. And if he spends too much money doing expensive tests on his patients, he's going to get fired, or he's going to get thrown out, or he's going to cost him, and, it's going to come out of his pocket when he starts doing these fancy tests. So, remember that in the old days when people paid for their health care themselves and went to the doctor, and the doctor was their advocate, and the doctor was a physician instead of now he's a provider, and they, of course, were patients rather than now they are consumers. Why we've seen a total transformation of the practice of medicine, even the nomenclature, and of course it has demeaned physicians and demeaned the practice of a once great and noble profession. Well, let's go to Will, who's calling us from Missouri. Hi, Will. How are you doing?
Very good, Dr. Stan and Lorraine. On an average day in Missouri from now until September, October, if I'm out, I'll pick up probably anywhere from 5 to maybe 20 ticks during the day, and at least a dozen of them will hit me, and I'll probably get maybe 40 or 50 of them off my dog each night. Is there any way of determining whether or not this area's got Lyme disease in the ticks to be concerned about it, or just to consider them a general woodland nuisance?
Wow, that's a lot of ticks to be pulling off of yourself and your dog.
That's not even to come close to the number of chiggers.
Yeah, well, and chiggers, yeah, it would. I'd be curious whether what diseases chiggers are carrying. You have to wonder. Anything that's sucking blood has got to be carrying some diseases. I would be very, very careful. The thing that we advise people who are going out into the wooded areas and that end up having ticks on them is to make sure that they are doing tick checks just as soon as they come home. And one of the best ways to do a tick check is to take a shower, because a lot of times you can feel the ticks before you see them. Some of the ticks that bite people are the size of the period at the end of a sentence. They are called nymphal ticks. They are very small. And so it's important that those ticks be, you know, immediately taken off of the body. And one of the best ways to locate them is with your hands, by feeling yourself as you're taking a shower. You will feel the raised bump sometimes when you don't even necessarily see it. So, no, I wouldn't take it as just a regular nuisance that you're coming in with ticks. I would be very, very careful. There are, there's permethrin spray that you can get to put on your clothing to help keep ticks off of you. A lot of times people will take and put duct tape around between their sock and their pant leg to stop the ticks from crawling up. And, of course, they've now found that one of the worst things that you can do in terms of tick exposure is to sit down on a log. I mean, usually when people go out and they're hiking, the first thing they want to do when they get a chance to rest is to sit on a log. They're pretty inviting. But it's also one of the places where there's the highest risk of picking up ticks. So it's really important to do the tick checks and to make sure you've got the ticks off of you and off of your dog, too, because, you know, the tick can obviously leave the dog at any point and come over to you. And dogs do get Lyme disease.
Well, in regards to the test, you said something about sending a tick in. Of course, I wouldn't be able to send in 50 or 100
ticks a day. You won't be able to do that. You know what you could do, though, is you could ask your county. We have local vector disease control districts in California, and you probably have something similar to that where you are, but you can ask for them to drag for ticks. What they do is they'll take a, a white cloth, and they will run it along the bush, and they will pick up, you know, ticks by doing that, and then they will take them in and they will test them to find out how many of the ticks in the area are carrying the Lyme disease, and they'll come up with a percentage. But it's not just Lyme disease you want to look for. You know, there's Ehrlichiosis and Bartonella. You want to find out what the incidence of that is as well in that area. And then you want to be really mindful of any symptoms that you could have. If you start coming down with a flu and it's not fall, it's a springtime flu, that's a real pointer that there's something going on. If you come up with a rash, you know that that's a real hallmark of Lyme disease and you should go in and get treatment. So those are the sort of things you really need to be on the lookout for.
Thank you.
And I think the major thing is, do you have Lyme disease in your area? I'd be surprised if you didn't. And this is all, we live in a different world, Will. This is not the disease I grew up, this is not the world I grew up in. There are all sorts of new and strange diseases out there. God bless, and thanks so much for calling. We'll be with Kirk in just a moment here. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening is Lorraine Johnson, and she, of course, is an advocate for people who have Lyme disease. Kurt is calling from Aptos. He says that he had Lyme disease. Did you got it cured, Kurt?
Yeah, Dr. Petrali got on it. Kaiser tried, but I was only the fourth case they'd seen, and they didn't know what to do with it.
Well, I tell you what, for those of you in our listening house who don't know, Dr. Petrali was an infectious disease specialist in this area and a wonderful friend, and of course he died, almost a decade ago now, and really a tremendous loss to our community. But certainly you're lucky you got in Petrali's hands, because if there was anything to know, he would have known it.
Oh, he was fabulous. But, you know, there are a couple things you've said over the years, and you know, I was selling an insurance policy. I was wearing a suit. I walked from my car down a concrete walk into a house, but they had a dog, and they were in Aptos. And ticks are in grass. It's not just deer. It's mice. Mm-hmm. And the ticks are everywhere. We've got loads of it here in Santa Cruz County. And the safest way not to get Lyme disease is walk on the beaches or walk in parking lots. You just can't go out in the woods. And something Stan has pointed out is that, you know, there are these people that are trying to get our country such that they drive people in the cities like they did in Romania. And it's suspicious where Lyme disease happened, right across the sound there. So what was it? Is it Plum Island, Dr. Stan?
Plum Island, right. Just across the inlet from Lyme, Connecticut.
So, you know, one is left to speculate. Is this a designer disease?
Well, we'll never know. So anyway, I'm glad that you're feeling well. And did you take oral or intravenous antibiotics?
Oral, and Kaiser had given me what the book said, which was, I forget the antibiotic, fairly common antibiotic in a light dosage. It didn't do anything. Petrali gave me about four times the dosage, and it knocked it out, but it was hell to go through. About the 16th day of it, I'm assuming it was a Herxheimer effect, all I could do was just sit there and tremble and shake and sweat. It was just hideous.
Well, I'm glad you got over it. We're out of time, but thank you so much for calling, Kurt.
Yeah, bye-bye. Now.
And Lorraine, thank you so very much for being with us. I really appreciate your sharing your knowledge with our listeners.
Well, thank you so much for having me, Stan. It's been a pleasure.
Good night, and God bless.
Good night.
All right, fine. Well, that was Lorraine Johnson, and of course, she is an advocate with the Lyme Association, and works with the Lyme Association here in California. This is a much more prevalent disease than most people realize, and it's something that we've got to be constantly aware of. And when you've got somebody who comes in with all sorts of bizarre symptoms, this is one thing that you have to think of. It used to be said, no syphilis and you know medicine, and now they say no Lyme disease. And you'll know medicine, because it can manifest in every system in the human body. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and we've been talking about Lyme disease this evening. We're going to make up a four-tape set. We don't have it made up yet, of course, but we're going to put together a four-tape set on Lyme disease, and we have a four-tape set on chronic fatigue, and we need to get more four-tape sets on all of these things so that you'll know where to go to get help today when these diseases plague you. We, of course, feel that immunity is such an important thing, but in this one instance, like a chronic use of antibiotics is very, very beneficial. And have you noticed all the efforts today that they're going to try to keep doctors and patients from use of antibiotics? Well, I'll tell you what, antibiotics can certainly many times cure chronic fatigue syndrome. They can control Lyme disease. And the CDC, which is not very interested in either one of those diseases, in fact, it almost appears sometimes that they've done everything they could to keep from finding out what the true cause is and how they should be treated. They're the ones who are so concerned about excessive use of antibiotics, and you have to ask yourself why. One book we carry, if you have not read it, you need to, is the story of the chronic fatigue syndrome. It's called Osler's Web, written by Hilary Johnson. It's one of the most exciting books, written just like a novel. The only trouble is it's a true story, an incredible story. And of course, when we hear the frustration of the people who have Lyme disease, it's like deja vu all over again. We carry the book Lab 257, the story of the army or military biological warfare laboratory on Plum Island, just across the inlet from Lyme, Connecticut. And of course, they were operating about the time that Lyme disease came about. We have that book. You really need to get it. You need to read it. You need to understand terrible things that really are happening. We have a book called The Virus and the Vaccine, about the virus that was in the original polio vaccine, and they've lied all these years about it, that the virus and the vaccine, and we recommend that book as well. So that's Lab 257, The Virus and the Vaccine. The book Osler's Web by Hilary Johnson, our 4-tape set on chronic fatigue syndrome. And I, if you'd like to get copies of any of the tapes we've done on the Lyme disease, of course, they're all available here at Radio Liberty. And our goal is, of course, to try to get this information out across America. Now, if you need more information, of course, we have a 4-tape set on population control. We have a video on population control. We have a video called None Dare Call It Genocide. That's None Dare Call It Genocide. I would suggest that many of you go up onto our website, radioliberty.com. We have a number of letters, a number of articles there on new diseases, on vaccinations. We have a number of articles on genetic engineering and how the government was actually engineering and creating new diseases under a special CIA operation that began back in 1953. And if you don't think that the government was interested in creating new diseases, why, we'll be glad to send you free of charge a copy of Dr. MacArthur's testimony before the military advisory committee. Actually, was the appropriations committee for the military back in 1969. We have this. We know it's accurate. Actually, I got somebody in the government sent me this mysteriously. They wanted me to have the information. And, of course, we know we get hits every day, a lot of hits from the military, from the CIA. They're listening to our programs. But the fascinating thing was Dr. MacArthur testified in 1969 he wanted $10 million to manufacture a new disease. And he said, of course, it'll destroy the immune system. Some people say we shouldn't do this because it's another means of mass killing, but we want the money anyway. Could that be really going on in the world today? Would they create diseases for mass killing? Give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. Ask for the Dr. MacArthur testimony. Pray for America. Pray for Radio Liberty. Till tomorrow, may the Lord be with you.